I'm pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University in Fremantle, I think, today, Martin.
Absolutely. Where would you rather be? Very few places as nice as Freo.
Well, with everything going on in the world, I don't really want to be anywhere much else. I mean, who'd want to be in Canberra at the moment with unhappy looking Liberal Party and National Party members around the streets? Furtively having coffee with each other, Labour people walking past with smiles on their face, but they've been through it all before. The smiles will be thin, not thick. What's happening with Susan Lee, the Nationals, the Libs, with the whole energy portfolio, and who's going to be the leader in a fortnight?
For all good questions, we don't really know. But just in terms of the emissions issue and net zero, no issue I can think of has divided the Liberal Party as consistently and as profoundly over a number of years now as emissions and what you can and can't do about it. And you recall that Malcolm Turnbull lost his gig over that. But that was only one of a whole ton of ructions that has happened over a period of time. And it's brought to a head all of these doubts about Suzanne Ley. I feel sorry for her, actually. I think that she hasn't been in the chair very long at all. And almost from the time that she jumped in the chair, various people have said their pieces, often sniping, often going off the reservation, so to speak, in terms of one thing or another. I don't know that she's really ever had much clear air to try and prosecute any message. I think she's been a bit stiff, really. But the reality is, it doesn't matter what I think, Michael. It's what her party colleagues think. And already those coffees behind the scenes are happening. And, it's not out of the question there might be some form of challenge. There's also, even if there's not one now between the end of the year, and it's only one more parliamentary sitting week. She's going to struggle in 26, probably. That her first issue is to settle the net zero one, and I suspect that they'll water down their commitment to net zero, possibly push out that date, for instance, of 2050, to try and placate some of the people in the party. That's probably the only solution I can see for her.
Well, what their policy is going to be has been pretty large, even though he hasn't finally formalised his advice to the party by Dan Tehan. It's pretty clear, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Nationals have said they're abandoning it, so that doesn't help them at all. There's a fight brewing there. And then plenty of the party membership, and they've passed motions to this effect at state level. Most of the states have said they don't want net zero. So they've got that. And then they've got this reality that to win seats that they lost in the cities last time, they've got to have a credible environmental policy. So she's very much stuck between a rock and a hard place here.
Martin, I've never forgotten walking into a supermarket when Turnbull was the PM and this question was on the table for the Coalition and the Libs, running into a Liberal Party senator that I knew. And I just casually, not thinking much of it, said, no doubt you'll be supporting these significant climate actions next week. And he looked at me aghast. I'm not sure whether he ever believed in such a policy, and I'm left with a feeling that really, in the coalition on both sides, not only the Nats but the Libs, there are those who don't really believe in climate change. Am
Oh,
I
I think there's plenty that don't. There's plenty that don't. And I think that at times they've come along for the ride because electorally they know that people care, particularly in the cities. I mean, that's a generalisation, of course. But you look at the seats they've lost, they've been decimated in these seats. They're reasonably affluent and probably conservative fiscally, but socially and environmentally quite. Cognizant of the issues. So that's why I think they've toed the line at times, but not at the moment.
Which makes you also wonder when there is a change of leadership, as I confidently predicted on the golf course on Tuesday, Martin, that there would be. And then I was asked who it would be handed to. I said, Andrew Hastie. And people looked at me aghast. I said, well, it seems pretty obvious to me. He's done the Keating thing, he's gone to the back bench. It's not quite Hawke and Keating, but he's waiting. He knows the scepticism's in the party. They want to call out for new leadership to take them forward. He's clean, he's Christian, he's been to Afghanistan. I mean, what more could you ask for?
Well, I think that some of his interventions earlier this year were very much of with that in mind. He threw a few bombs around, came out strongly on a range of issues, then resigned. But he's not the only contender. I think Angus Taylor, who only lost by a couple of votes last time to Suzanne Ley, would consider himself a contender and probably waiting in the wings as well. So there could even be a three-way contest potentially. That's not entirely out of the question. But there's a lot up in the air, and this time of the year is typically when those moves are made.
No doubt Angus Taylor considers himself a contender even when the position becomes vacant. Not sure that many others will, though. Leaving that short, sharp aside, what was Basil Zemplis up to, saying that he was absolutely for net zero 2050, as I read him?
I think Basil's cut from a bit different cloth. Look at where his seat is. He represents Churchlands, which is exactly in the seat of Curtin, which was lost by the Liberals to a Teal independent. And he will look around the city, the suburban seats that the Liberals have lost, and pretty much assume that they've got to make some inroads into those seats. So I think he's been pretty adamant that they shouldn't abandon net zero. But that's only him. I think there's other people in the WA Liberal Party that are very much keen to abandon it. So he might find a fight within his own party at some stage on that.
Martin, which brings us to the comment you made a few minutes ago that there's only a short number of sitting days left before everyone goes off to their Christmas parties and the like. What's going to happen to the EPBC amendment bill? Are we going to see a new EPA in Canberra? Are we going to see the improvements, according to the Samuel report, brought to fruition, or is it all going to fall in a heap and not happen?
The Environment Minister Murray Watt has brought this bill forward and said repeatedly that he wants to negotiate, and he's kind of hinted at a few areas where he would negotiate with either Liberals or the Greens. It's quite funny because what he would get as an outcome by negotiating with the Liberals might be quite different to what he would get as an outcome by negotiating with the Greens. So really, this could go in two completely different directions. There's some thinking in the Liberal Party that they could consider negotiating on this because they've got so many other fires that are engulfing them at the moment. Industry's really raring for something, for a deal to be done. They want clarity, they want consistency. There are aspects of this in the bill that seek to make the approvals process simpler, more simple. And that's why industry is reasonably keen on it. So maybe that might influence them as well. The Greens are aware that at times when they haven't negotiated with Labor, nothing's happened in the space where they would like changes to happen. So there's maybe some incentive there, but they seem to be also some way away from Labor right at the moment.
Well, we've already had vision of Murray Watt meeting with a range of people, including our Rog and Rita, who were in Canberra the other day. Rog and Rita seem to call the shots when it comes to economic policy, resource policy, and no doubt have had a lot of words to say about the EPBC amendments, which probably sound a lot like what industry is telling the government. But Rog and Rita were in Canberra ostensibly over the GST carve-up, Martin. It seems to me to have been carefully stage managed on both sides. Do you reckon?
I think this visit's all about reassuring Western Australians that they're out there campaigning for them. I can't see how advertisements in newspapers in, say, Sydney or Melbourne make any difference whatsoever. I think it's I don't th can't see any outcome there that would make a difference. And likewise, aside from WA MPs that are laser-like focused on this. I don't think they'll be shifting that many other minds. Anthony Albanese and Suzanne Ley are on board with this because they know the politics. They know that there's so many marginal seats in Western Australia. So I think they're on board before this visit, and I think they'll stay on board after this visit, for that reason primarily.
No one will forget how Scott Morrison kept tripping over things because he was so in love with Western Australia and the GST carve-up at the election that he lost. And it seems to be exactly the same routine all over again. It's been clever politics by the state.
Well, I think that it's all about, it's all there for show, really. Let's go over there. I'm not criticizing it as a visit. I mean, that's what premiers and treasurers routinely should do. So, but is it going to shift the dial on the GST? No. Is it wise for the premier and treasurer to go over and lobby the prime minister and other ministers in the state's interest? Of course it is. So, in that respect, it's a wise move, but it won't shift the dial on the GST.
When they were sitting up the front of the plane in business class, just the two seats there, Martin, I know because I have sat there, and the two of them were talking to each other, Rog and Rita. And Rita said to Rog, "Why did you give that funny answer at that business lunch the other day about whether I'll be the next premier after you? What did you make of that?"
I think I'm not sure whether that was a scripted answer or not. I don't think it was, Michael. There's these. I'm presuming this is some way off. But when that leadership comes, you can't. No incumbent can control what happens after they go, no matter how tight their grip is. And you saw this with Mark McGowan, who was all powerful at the time. He walks away. I think he would have liked to see Roger take over, and eventually he did, but didn't stop the factions from having their own say in the meantime. So I think who knows what'll happen if he steps aside one day, but he won't get to control it.
Well, I must say, if I'd been Roger and had been asked the question, I would have said something like, "Well, what a great question. Labor Party has its own devices, as you know, but my goodness, she's a great treasurer, fabulous deputy premier, and sure she'd make a good premier if that's what everyone decides." Anyway, I'm sure she will, and she'll probably get there. But politics, a lot can happen in a week, Martin. And if you've been watching, as most of the world was, Mamdani's election as mayor of New York City, you'd say, "Oh, golly, I'm still a bit surprised." Were you?
Look, the polls have been predicting it, and I mean, it's still a fascinating development. Of course, as interesting as his policies are, he is mayor of New York. He's a mayor of one city. It might be the most famous city in America, but his ability to enact radical economic change, with most of his economic policies that he's talked about, will be limited, I suspect. So, you could run through them. They're quite significant sort of promises, but at local government level, you've got fairly limited means to do that. I think that people, Democrats in particular, and there's plenty of them in New York, I think they wanted someone to take up the fight to Trump, and that's what he really represents.
It's really interesting, the campaign itself. I mean, it brought people alive. People have been writing recently about him being a super salesman and how much you can trust super salesmen. I have Elon Musk in mind as well. But the catchphrase was, the slogan was, "A city we can afford." And the core message was tackling New York's cost of living crisis head on. And he's talking about rent freezes for accommodation, free buses, universal childcare. And a lot of people say, "Well, how do you do that?" It is very interesting, Dave. The most important change seems to be that he's been telling everybody about all the great eateries outside Manhattan, all around the other boroughs. And people have been flooding in to try Afghan food and Indian food and you name it food, Martin.
Oh, look, one of your key roles as mayor is to be promoter in chief, for your area, and that's the one thing. You put your city on the map by talking it up and promoting it. On the issue of cost of living, if we're complaining about, Perth, Sydney, Melbourne, places like that being expensive, goodness knows, and what would it be like living in New York City? So, no wonder people are feeling that. It's a natural area for him to target, and I hope he can make a difference. But some of these issues are pretty structural.
Trump in the final days, or probably on many occasions, actually described him as a communist. He described himself as a democratic socialist, I think. But he also wants to impose a 1% tax. It goes back to the 99% and the 1%, the Wall Street sit-ins and so on. crazy but interesting idea of just coming out with a straight on levy for the people who've got lots of money to make things easier for the poorer people of New York. Can you imagine that happening here?
Well, we're quite different in some ways, but I mean, New York is a fascinating city, and we have a lot of economic disparity in our communities. But imagine living in New York, where you've got extreme wealth, extraordinary wealth, and very public poverty in the same city and in exactly the same spaces. So that would be staring people in the face, really. So it's probably one of London's a little bit similar, but those cities, they have some of the greatest level, highest levels of economic disparity in the world.
Martin, we've been talking about what, a year or two or three or five ago would have just been the usual sort of fodder on a podcast like ours, just talking about regular politics. Is all quiet on the Ukraine front? It sort of feels like it.
There have been some gains made by Russia in the field over the last week, a couple of strategic villages that they've taken over. I wouldn't say that that's radically changing the broader picture. And my thinking around this probably hasn't changed like many analysts, and that's that Putin's waiting this out, and he thinks that he can outlast the appetite of Trump, but other European leaders to be invested in this. And that's why he's happy to stall discussions.
I see the tomahawk is not completely off the table. Trump just keeps teasing by mentioning it occasionally, prevaricating or saying maybe no, maybe yes.
Well, I mean, this is where European leaders get a bit frustrated because, on the one hand, he'll talk about how he has a good relationship with Putin at times and how he's confident they'll come to the table. And then next breath, he's imposing sanctions and talking about the possibility of tomahawks. Then the next week, he's telling you they're off the table. And really, it's been very hard to divine exactly where Trump sits on Ukraine. I think he's genuinely interested in peace, but I'm not sure he's got the tools and the know-how to actually bring that about.
He doesn't have to remain so actively involved and interested in Gaza at the moment because the 20-point peace plan is meant to be, in a sense, being implemented. Things are still happening. The remains of hostages are still being discovered slowly and returned. There's some awfully disturbing photographs on the BBC website as of yesterday when a journalist was able to get in for the first time. And it's even more raised in the bits shown in the footage than I'd imagined. How do you assess what's happening there? Is it just about ready to bring in the independent force to maintain peace or whatever it's going to do?
They do need to move to the next steps on that part, on that peace proposal, because at the moment there's a state of limbo. You've talked about the devastation there, and it's very you need to enforce the peace and security, particularly within Gaza, to provide some degree of certainty. The one area that still appears to be causing ructions is that yellow line. So the IDF, the Israeli army, is still occupying part of Gaza at the moment, and that's called, where that stops and finish, I think that's gradually becoming clearer, but it's caused consternation and some tension and spot fires. I'd point out the peace at the moment is still a very fragile one. So the sooner they're able to move to concrete steps, including getting a stabilization force in, the better.
It was an amazing story during the week how a senior female Israeli lawyer within the system was a whistleblower about the treatment of Palestinians. Did you see that?
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, that was really interesting, and it does speak to, that there are people in the system that are really concerned with. Within the Israeli system, being really concerned with how a range of things have been conducted, and she's been dismissed from her post for leaking information about that. So it's a that's that was a really interesting news item this week.
Martin, the other topic we haven't talked about a lot lately, but if things keep going bad in the way the UN fears, won't be much need for a podcast like ours, and that is the state of climate action or climate inaction. COP30's on in Brazil, and the world leaders have been taking aim at Trump. The UN have said just how bad things are, and we're getting very hot. It's almost like an issue of our time, of our children's time, of our grandchildren's time, is being rolled up and dropped over the side of the jetty.
I think there'll be some people will find this COP meeting perhaps more frustrating than previous meetings. And it's not that the US ever charged headlong into addressing climate change, but at the moment with Trump as president, they're even that even the rhetoric they're not getting through COP 30. So I'd expect that there'll be the usual communique that comes out about this, but I think it'll be more rhetoric than action that'll actually stem from this conference. That'll frustrate a lot of people. And a reminder that climate change is a global issue. And so, we get our actions about domestic debates around it, but unless there's a consistent global consensus and action, nothing actually changes.
And I suppose that does feed back into the domestic debate that we started on about that racking the Liberal and National parties at the moment. Sir Keir Starmer, the UK Prime Minister, said to the COP people that he acknowledged the waning political support on climate change, and he said it had been a unity issue internationally and in the UK, but quote unquote, today, sadly, that consensus is gone. It really is a really interesting sort of edge that we've arrived at with the climate debate, Martin. Do you have any predictions
Oh,
where that?
it's a good quote that you're talking about. I mean, what you're seeing there is profound pessimism that is now engulfing the rhetoric of a lot of leaders, even those leaders that perhaps would like to see more action. And they're conceding that, the level of political support for this is going on. I think one of the aspects of the Trump presidency, and don't want to make this all about Trump because this is a global issue, but he's promoting America first really strongly, and I think it's caused a lot of other countries to think about their countries first. Now, that's not new. Every political leaders do this, but climate change is a global issue. So unless lots of major countries, lots of major emitters are prepared to make sacrifices or make change what they're doing, nothing's going to change. So that's I think that shift in rhetoric and focus has been unhelpful in terms of climate change too.
Well, Martin, it's been an interesting week, couple of weeks, geo, nationally, locally, in politics. Who knows what'll happen in the next week, but see you next Friday to find out.
Look forward to it as always.
See you.